I feel like I need to start the show with an apology because I kind of disappeared on everyone for like maybe 4 months and I don't know what else to say, but like I was going through some shit, you know, and I've been trying to figure out how to make an event, an intimate event podcast, and that's like kind of complicated, but I feel like I got some better ideas about it, and I feel like I wasn't talking to who I was supposed to be talking to. Like, I have to continue to talk to you, the listener, you know, my like 4 dozen best friends in the world. And so I do, though, I like had this plan that I was going to do this like multi-part podcast, like about Los Angeles. And the thing is, if I was working on this full time with like a small team of people, then I definitely could have made like a really amazing serial podcast that culminated with like Lyft car crashes and stuff. But like, I work a full-time job, you know, and like my shins hurt, my wrists hurt, my shoulders hurt. And so like, I've just decided I just have to do the best podcast that I can do for every month that I do it. You know, I mean, I think I need to do it every month. I don't mean to abandon you because when my favorite, not even my favorite, not that I'm your favorite podcast, but like something I find acceptable that I occasionally listen to just as disappears, you know, I wish it wouldn't do that. And so I do have a way to like conceptualize this as Los Angeles, though, which is that like life in Los Angeles is all about having intimate conversations while other people are listening to you, because you get like no privacy, the walls are thin. And so like, that's a quintessential Los Angeles experience, is like fighting with a loved one while like 17 people in a circle around you are like listening to you. But then it's also kind of beautiful because like people understand that you're going through some shit, like I was saying previously. So I do have an audience. The other thing is I was trying to control my audience and then do podcasts that were specific to my audience. And then I realized that's an unrealistic expectation. So, anyways, yeah, and I'm also working on a Dave Good Show theme park, which I plan on completing like 3 minutes before I die. So, you know, it'll be like Dave Good themed rides, you know, like just like all the different ways to experience Dave Good, you know, in the form of a theme park for like a reasonable price, you know, but not cheap. So, so I do have an audience. Like, 2 are young women that I work with, and I don't know what exactly the protocol is on that. I mean, I just had a sexual harassment training and it wasn't like you can't invite your coworkers to hear you do storytelling and comedy in your friend's living room. Like, I don't know what the rules are, but they're like full grown adults and they have come on their own. Like, they're both very talented. Everyone here is very talented. I mean, I'm still holding to that. Though one person is talented in the world of finance, and like hearing finance jargon before I do a podcast is very difficult. It's like as complicated of a thing as I can listen to. But no, so it's a good and interesting crowd. One person here does a thing called Allergy Girl Comics, which I think is a really good idea, and I don't want to get into it. But yeah, so it's cool. So I've been thinking a lot about politics, and I didn't want to talk about politics. Like, I'm a very political person, and so, like, this show, so much of the evolution of this show is that this is not about politics. Like, everyone can come to the Dave Good Show. That's, like, a core value of my show. So I started to think about, like, how I could, like, address concepts that I had been thinking about, and I also thought about, like, if I was going to have an audience who like a majority, I'm sure, do not like sports, that I would talk about sports because I have this like unique ability. It's one of my secret skills, is to tell stories about sports that are interesting to people who do not like sports. And so this story that I have is called 5 Claps for Matt Thomas. All right. And so I grew up in like a basketball mecca, right? It's Central Iowa town, Ames, Iowa. Like, it is like an epically, here, let me move this. It's like an epically, it's just a really great basketball environment, you know? And, we generally had a pretty good team, you know? And the thing that I liked about it the most is that when they introduced the opposing team, right? Everyone in the audience would clap five times, right? And every other sporting event that you would go to, when they introduce the opposing team, like everyone just boos, right? But we would clap five times. And I thought that was super classy. And I thought that it like, and still do, like expresses like a meta understanding of sports that like you cannot have a contest without an opponent. And so that's like one of the dumbest things about our current sports culture is everyone's like, oh, I'm the champion. I'm the greatest. But yeah, you're not the champion if there is no league. You know, you have to play games against all of these other teams who then have to be doing their best and you have to be doing your best. And it has to be a fair contest in order to create the sense of a championship. And people don't really realize that. So, you know, like I said, I grew up in this basketball mecca. And that was like another thing because like we would watch the team even if it wasn't good, you know, like you just like support your team. And I definitely had some like core values from that. Like I wrote this show down in a notebook that I got from my old boss at this museum I worked at. And I actually built a visitor services system based on Iowa State's offense at the time, right? So I'm like deep into this shit. And like the two people here who work with me, like my customer service system is based on the secondary Fred Hoiberg break. Like it's all about transition basketball, right? So anyway, so that's the thing. And so it's like I'm into Iowa State. And I believe I had moved to LA at this time, but shit gets real good because we get a new coach who is like the hometown hero. Oh, so it's like a guy I grew up with who was very good at basketball. And then he's very smart about basketball and we start to get really good, right? And so now I'm like in it deep. And at the time there wasn't really like a Twitter presence, but there was like a hardcore forum presence, right? And so I was like deep into the Iowa State basketball forums because it was like all I thought about because it just kept getting better and better. And so like we were good. Like every year we had a chance to win the championship and we got this player from Wisconsin named Matt Thomas, right? And Matt Thomas, I need to say, was a white basketball player. And so just like talking about basketball, like I'm a 42-year-old white man talking about a white basketball player. I just want to acknowledge that for a minute that like there's a real disconnect between like what white basketball players go through that is challenging and what black basketball players go through that is challenging. And I'm going to address that later because like Matt Thomas goes through a lot, but I don't want to discount it. And I just want to say that like even though Matt Thomas might be my favorite basketball player, I don't necessarily like the idea of white people always picking a white person as their favorite basketball player. You know, I think that you should like think about what their attributes are and what their values are and find a way. And I actually really like Allen Iverson. And funny, fun fact about Patrick, even though he hates sports, Patrick is very good at sports and he will beat me at basketball while saying incorrect facts about Allen Iverson just to get in my head. And it works. So anyways, Matt Thomas comes to Iowa State and he is the best player out of Wisconsin and he is supposed to be very good, right? And he even kind of looks like our coach and even kind of looks like us. I mean, that's the crazy thing about Iowa State basketball at this time. Like we aren't from a diverse gene pool in Ames, Iowa. Like we're just like part of Germany, part of Ireland, whatever. So it's this crowd of 12,000 people who all look the same with a coach that looks like them and then kicks the shit out of the opponent. It's incredible. And so Matt Thomas, much heralded basketball player, comes to Iowa State. And the thing is, he's good. He's very good, but he is not great. And he was supposed to be great. And so he's supposed to make almost, you know, he's supposed to make 50% of his three-point shots and he makes 39% of his three-point shots. And I'm reading about this on the forum and something terrible starts to happen, like this Lord of the Flies phenomenon, right? And everyone on the forums starts keying in on Matt Thomas. And so after every game, there's like an entire thread titled Matt Thomas, where everyone shits on Matt Thomas, right? And I can't believe it, right? Like I'm from the town of the five claps. Like I don't understand how someone, so this is a kid. I mean, I don't mean to say kid because he's an adult, but a 19-year-old young man who is going to the one place that writes all the time about his team and is always like, fuck Matt Thomas, right? And I'm reading this and it's bothering me and I'm reading this and it's bothering me and I start to then dig into the tape. Sports people call it eating tape. I start to eat tape and like go through every single Iowa State game and like document all the times where Matt Thomas is playing well. Like he's a very good player on a very good basketball team, but he's not great like they thought he was going to be. And also, I think it's partially because of his race that he looked like us, and we wanted the guy who looked like us to be a stone cold killer, like our coach. And so, like, one of the reasons I was like, you should tell this story, because, like, this is the most read thing I've ever written in my life, is one day on that basketball forum, I was like, listen, Matt Thomas could have gone to many schools. You are cyber bullying Matt Thomas. Like, you are keying in on this guy for no reason. And this is ridiculous. And God, I got so much bullshit, like the bullshit that I hate the most about sports, that fucking bootstraps Republican conservative bullshit where they're like, oh no, you know, you're only responsible to yourself. And if he's not cutting it, that's his fault. And I, as like a 45-year-old alcoholic, deserve to be shitting on this 19-year-old kid. So anyways, that post where I'm like, fuck you, you're cyberbullying Matt Thomas, gets read 15,000 times. And then like the website creates a cyberbullying policy, right? So anyways, the summer goes by and Matt Thomas writes an editorial for the newspaper. And it's funny when I read it because like, I don't know how old at this time, 35. So like, it's clearly like a 19-year-old business major who plays basketball has written this thing. Like, it's not poetry, but he was like, I wanted to reach out to the Iowa State fans and say that my dad killed himself. And that's why I wasn't playing that well for those couple of years that I felt like, I mean, he didn't even say this, but everyone's wondering what was wrong. And that's like what I was talking about. Like, these are human beings. You know, so anyways, Matt Thomas finishes his Iowa State career as a very excellent basketball player. And still, like, always a weird comment against him. I mean, I think we won 3 Big 12 tournament championships with Matt Thomas as a basketball player. You know, everyone on that team plays in the pros right now. I'll really never recover that we didn't win a title with that level of talent. But Matt Thomas graduates. He plays well he doesn't get drafted. He plays well in the development league, but then he signs a contract in Spain. And I'm like kind of stoked. I'm like, fuck yeah, Matt Thomas, get the fuck out of here and go to Spain, which has the most beautiful women on planet Earth, and just like be a pro basketball player. And he goes to Spain, he gets some distance, and instead of making 39% of his threes, he starts to make 49% of his threes. And I don't know if he wins a championship with whatever Spanish team, but he plays well enough that he just got signed by the Toronto Raptors, and he now plays professional basketball and he gets paid $900,000 a year because that shit's published on ESPN. And I know there's a thing about basketball players like not making their money, but I honestly feel like Matt Thomas earned that money. And like the best thing is that he went to Toronto with like the nicest fans in sports, like these like incredibly supportive Toronto fans. And just on Wednesday, when I was getting ready to do this podcast, I like looked up Matt Thomas on Twitter and he was trending because he was making tons of threes against the Milwaukee Bucks. So, you know, Matt Thomas is my favorite basketball player, you know, and I really identify with him and just like how we can have things going on in our lives and then we become criticized for that. And just like, it's both a story about like not being judgmental, and it's also about like when people on your own team behave badly. Cause I mean, I'll never feel the same way about Iowa State sports. I mean, sports is about this. It's about this tribalism. Like I was talking about sports with Patrick earlier, and Patrick was like, don't you think sports are like, I don't know, kind of fascist? And I'm like, yeah, they are a little bit fascist, you know? But, you know, I still love Iowa State. And I understand that, like, there's, you know, however many fans, there's 100,000 Iowa State fans. Not all of them are going to be cool, you know? And even though Toronto has, like, the coolest fans in the world, they're not all cool, you know? They're not all cool. Just to get back to the race thing, like, I was like, just coincidentally, there was an article published about the Boston Celtics. And the Boston Celtics had this player, Bill Russell, who I don't know if you've heard of Bill Russell. He's one of the most famous basketball players. He won 11 championships, considered to be the best defensive player of all time. Bill Russell got an award from a Boston country club, went to that award. While he was at the country club, people broke into his house, spray painted the N-word on the walls, and took a shit on his bed. So, compared to that, Matt Thomas had it easy, you know? Like, and Bill Russell was always described to me as this, like, angry man, and no one understands why Bill Russell is angry, but it's like when your own fucking fans attack you, that just, like, folds the world then on itself. Like, these are the people who are supposed to like you. You know, and I thought about that, and honestly, like, I've hated the Boston Celtics my entire life. I mean, that's, like, why I have hated them, you know? But then I thought about it and I read more into this ESPN article. And the thing is, the Boston Celtics also have this ability, this reputation for taking very good care of their former players and like lionizing them. And, you know, just in terms of like not being judgmental and also knowing people from Boston, you know, I do believe that the not racist Boston fans are trying to be extra special, not racist and like really help out their players. But, you know, so that's my story about Matt Thomas. Just a dude who's good at basketball, you know, and very good, you know. So like I feel like a Dave Good theme park would be like a various, like my various like emotional states, you know. There'd be like, obviously they'd be like Dave Bad Town, you know, where like things were hard to understand, you know. I mean, dude, the roller coaster thing is funny. Like, I went to a roller coaster party, like, when I first lived in Minneapolis with, like, a bunch of, like, now semi-famous to famous artists and, like, designers and stuff. Like, a real elite crew. And we get there and someone's like, so no one here likes roller coasters, right? And I'm like, what? We just came to an amusement park. Like, I fucking love roller coasters. I've been on one of the fastest roller coasters ever created. It was amazing. I had to smoke a cigarette the second I finished that shit. And anyways, and the thing is, when I was at this, then I was at a party with these people, and now two of them were getting married, and the guy had never been to a strip club. And he was like, yo, have any of you dudes ever been to a strip club? And I'm like, well, yes, I've been to a strip club. Like, it's a little bit weird that none of you guys have. And the one guy goes, whoa, you're not only the roller coaster guy, you're also the strip club guy. So I've got two stories. I'm thinking about taking a road trip, right? And so I actually had like a really good conversation with like an elite customer service professional, which is like one of the best people to talk to and, you know, the most underpaid people in the history of people being paid things. I was talking about taking a road trip because I hate flying. And they were like, why do you hate flying? And I'm like, well, one time I was leaving, I was flying out of LAX and I got to LAX, which is the most overcrowded airport. And, the line for security was out the fucking door. Like, I get there and have to like line up on the street to go through security. And like, you have to get there so insanely early. I'm like 3 hours early because I'm very punctual, but like I'm waiting in this line forever. And then they're like, okay, we're going to open up this secondary security line and like ride everyone through this line. So now I'm going through this like weird long series of hallways. And then I finally get up to security. And then like, there's all these people, like everyone is just like so tired. And so like, you know, whatever, discombobulated from this experience. And they're like, hold up the line. And they like grab my bag and they pull out a full can of V8 juice. And they're like, whose V8 is this? And I was like, you gotta keep your diet straight. Which is the V8 commercial from like 1987. It's like a leaning guy and he drinks a V8 and he straightens up. And like, they didn't laugh because like no one in LA is going to give you a laugh that you didn't totally earn, but they like felt like I maybe deserved a laugh, you know. And that's the thing, is I fucking hate airport security so much. Like, and the security people are always mad at me, and I'm like, I don't fly all the time. This is like something I do every 6 months, and the rules are always different. Like, I didn't know that you couldn't bring V8 in a sealed can. on the plane, I mean, I didn't even think about it. And so, like, I, like, I'm, like, flying back from L.A. People say that L.A. is an easy town to move to and a hard town to move away from. But I moved away the first time and totally failed. And I'm going through security and I'm, like, sold almost all of my items for $40. It's weird. Like, $40, that's what people are going to pay for a thing, I've learned. And so the alarms go off. They're like, what's in your bag? A guy pulls me to the side. And this is also when the TSA people aren't being paid because there's like a government shutdown. And the guy like opens my bag and inside my bag is $50 worth of change. Because I like had all this change and I didn't take it to the change thing before I left town. And the guys pulled out this change. And I was like, I hope you get a paycheck soon. And he was like, yeah, me too, man, me too. Oh, so St. Louis, like, so I went to college in St. Louis and I was like, it's weird. I run into a lot of academics in my like current life and I was like good. I have this whole life of being an up and coming St. Louis broadcaster that like almost no one witnessed except for me, you know? And I was like, how do I describe St. Louis? And it's like, St. Louis is like where I learned how to crack safes. And then after I cracked my biggest safe, the person who taught me how to crack the safe, like stole all the money, you know? And so like, I don't know how to feel about it. I'm like, I'm grateful that I learned how to crack safes, but then also you stole all the money. But then also that's like the final lesson of a safe cracker, you know, like you got to like, yeah, totally. I'm just saying that like, it's like, you got to, you can't just like, you don't just have to create the brilliant creative product. You also have to maintain control of that product. So I would like create things other people would. That's why I call the Dave Good Show the Dave Good Show, because then like it's the Dave Good Show, you know. If they're going to buy it, they at least know that they're like not going to like, you know, they don't get to sit here behind all the books and trophies. So yeah, and so I think about St. Louis all the time. Like Patrick one time, like when I was doing the earlier podcast, like described me as like the number one enemy of the St. Louis Tourism Bureau. Do you remember that? I mean, the thing, I don't mean to shit on, but there was this time in St. Louis where I had like been to a hockey game and I got real fucked up and I had a big long ponytail and this like really loud Hawaiian shirt on. And I was like so drunk that the people I were with were like, oh, let's go down to the river and go to those like trashy young people bars that like just whatever, basic ass bars. And so we go into this like shitty sports bar, whatever. And there's like no one in there. And this is like a huge bar with like a dance floor. And I'm sitting there with my friend Seth, who also has long hair and, we're just like two wasted hippies sitting at this like trashy sports bar. And these like, women come in who are wearing like high heels with like midriffs and like, lower back tattoos, you know? And, they all walk in and they're the only people in the bar besides us. And I look at them, I'm like, you guys have really nice shoes. And like, they were like so insulted. And so they're like sitting there and I'm like, okay, you guys don't have to talk to me. Like, I'm fucking awesome. I'm amazing. But like, whatever, we're the only ones in here, you know? And, then like a guy gets up into the DJ booth and is like, we're going to play the thong song. It's time for the thong song, everyone. It's a thong song. And these women get up on the bar in front of me, pull their pants down and shake their asses in my face and then pull their pants back up and go right back to ignoring me. Those are my interim stories. And then here's the final story. Thank God. Thank fucking God. Okay. So, anyways, like being in situations you didn't intend to be in when you're super hungover, also about other things that tangentially relate to politics. So I am in Los Angeles. I really need to get a job. I'm Lyft driving, you know, but this job is exhausting. It doesn't pay well. Oh my God. Side note, like the Lyft drivers of Los Angeles finally sued over the bathrooms at LAX, like, thank God, because, like, there is nothing more frightening than the bathrooms in the Lyft holding lot at LAX. Like, it is, like, the fucking worst. And there is actually a law that you have to have one bathroom per 20 people if, like, someone's your, employee, but since they're subcontractors or whatever, there are 6 bathrooms for 2,000 people. Porta potties. So anyways, this is why, one of the many reasons, you know, and the thing is, I've still been, even though I was going to tell some more Lyft stories this time, but I held off for reasons that I'll keep to myself, and I'm going to do them on my birthday show. I think we should do a birthday show, Patrick, but I started applying for jobs, and I apply for a job as an SAT, ACT tutor, right? I take this quiz ahead of time, and then the organization contacts me, and they interview me, and they're like, do you really think you could tutor kids about the SAT and the ACT? And I'm like, yeah, I was always good at taking tests. My mom was a teacher. My Aunt Lena was a teacher. Like, all the women in my family have college degrees. Did you know Ames or Iowa City, Iowa invented the ACT? And blah, 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 blah. I get myself an interview, right? But I'm not thinking about sports, which I should be. And the Cubs are in the National League Championship against the Dodgers, right? And I'm a huge Cubs fan. And my friend Eric, who's not even a Cubs fan, has a stroke of genius and gets a whole bunch of tickets to this baseball game, right? And then his comedian friends don't come because comedians are assholes and idiots, we all know. And they don't come to this amazing experience. And so I get to bring all of my friends to the game. And then, by the way, Eric's comedian's friends got their own tickets to a later game because they realized how fun it was. Sorry, Eric, I just really want to call them out for that. Because, like, Eric, like, made this incredible experience. So I went to see the Cubs with my friends from Iowa, including one of my closest friends who was a softball player, and she brought her glove, you know, and we go to Dodger Stadium, and we watch the Cubs kick the shit out of the Dodgers. And a beer at Dodger Stadium is $16, but it's a 24-ounce beer, so that's how they convince you to pay $16 for a beer. And one of my friends there was a finance guy, and he was like, hey, do you think I should buy the beers because they're $16? And I was like, I do think you should buy the beers because they are $16. And so I proceeded to drink like 12 16-ounce beers at the Cubs game. I don't know. I smoked like 40 fucking cigarettes. Hard to say, but I get totally hammered. And then the next day I have a job interview at the SAT, ACT tutor place, which is in Beverly Hills. So I wake up the next day and I'm like pretty fucked, and you know, but whatever, I do my thing. I mean, jeans and a tie, I'm telling you folks, jeans and a tie opens more doors than you can possibly imagine. So I put on jeans and a tie and I drive to Beverly Hills, and I know things about Beverly Hills, like where, how far away I'm gonna have to park if I don't want to pay like $40 to park. So I park super far, and I have 2 highball energy drinks. One that I'm drinking, one that's in my pocket. And I walked the like 3, sorry, I don't know. It was probably like a 25-minute walk through like the blazing hot sun into this Beverly Hills like office building. And like I get in there and like I'm like, fuck, I am like pretty fucked right now, you know? And I like go into the bathroom and I splash water on my face. And then I drink this second giant energy drink, right? Try to like this like huge intense dose of caffeine and vitamins to like have enough juice to like go to this job interview. Now, I don't have a pencil, right? Because I'm like, why should I go buy pencils? This is a testing facility. They're obviously going to have fantastic pencils, right? And so I go in there and I give them my resume, and the guy's like, okay, so you're here. And he looks at my resume and he sees at the top that it says Lyft driver, right? And he like does not like that, right? And he like goes to he gestures to his buddy, the like more aggressive Uber nerd, right? And he's got his keys on a Dungeons and Dragons 20-sided die, right? And I'm like, oh, hey, dude, nice D20, you know? And he's like, oh, yeah, whatever. And he's like, okay, so I'm like, I've been told that I have to go there, and what I have to do is I take the most difficult third of the SAT and the ACT, both math and verbal. And if I pass, excuse me, not pass, if I score extremely high on either the verbal or the math, I will get a job, right? Or I'll get an interview. So the guy gives me the test and I'm like, hey, do you have a pencil? And he's like, and he gives me like a stubby, dull golf pencil, this like 3-inch thing pencil. And he puts me in a glass room in front of the entire office building, and I get the most difficult third of the SAT and the ACT, right? And the thing is, I had told them when I was interviewing that I had aced the science part and I was good at verbal, but I wasn't really good at math. But they're like, no, if you ace the science, we should give you the math test. So I take the math test and I don't know like any of that shit, you know, like what the fuck? Like I got a communications degree 18 years ago and you're asking me like complicated equation questions, but whatever. I take the science, I take the verbal. Oh, and when they give me the test, they're like, you're going to want to hold on to your answers because you're going to want to know what you got wrong. Right. Anyways, I turn in my test. Whatever, one Uber nerd goes and talks to the other Uber nerd, and I can see them like talking and almost arguing because I only miss one on the verbal and those fuckers have to interview me. And I also ace the science again. I'm sorry, the science part of the ACT, it's a piece of cake. It's just a bunch of fucking graphs. It's like, is the red line at 30? Yeah, ACT, the red line is at 30. I'm a fucking scientist, you know, so... Anyway, so they like, I can see them like arguing about them having to interview me, and the guy comes in and he interviews me and he's like, so like, how interesting, man, you're a Lyft driver. That's gotta be great. You're like driving around and you could like be driving people around and you could stop and tutor someone. I'm like, yeah, that's what I'm saying. I could be like driving around. I could stop and tutoring someone. Yoni's like, well, do you have any experience as a tutor? And I was like, no, but I bet as like the number one testing agency in Beverly Hills, you probably have a training program, and I feel like I could make it through that training program. And the guy's like, we do, you know? And he like takes a minute and he's like, I gotta be honest with you, you know, no Beverly Hills mom is gonna let a Lyft driver who went to Webster University tutor their son. He's like, you should get a job with one of those other testing agencies that's not as good as us. And then you should like circle back. And I just like can't express how much smarter and cooler I was than that fucking guy. You know, like, fuck that guy. Fuck that Beverly Hills testing asshole, you know. And like fucking class is a real thing. Class is real, you know. Like I was a Lyft driver. It didn't matter. Whereas like obviously, like listen to me. I'm a pretty good fucking talker. I could inspire a 17-year-old kid to do a little bit more work on their fucking verbal, you know. Like, I mean, come on, but like whatever. I was so happy that that shit was over, you know. And the Cubs, fucking 13 hits. It was amazing. So yeah, and then like soon after that, I left LA like permanently. Oh, and that time I took the train, you know, which has a way easier security protocol.
So Dave, I have a story I can share with you about TSA that I don't think anybody else can because when I was traveling to back and forth to the East Coast to visit my family with my kids. So the kids always get on the plane, they've got a little backpack with toys and books and things for them to keep busy. And we get a TSA and all of a sudden there's like this whole hall blue and they're like, what? You have to come. And then they're like, what is going on? And they're like, the x-ray is freaking out. And I'm looking and I'm like, oh, I know exactly what this is. My kid has a tin can and inside are a bunch of plastic sticks and magnetic ball bearings. And you can fill things out of it. And it looks like, so you've got this thing on the x-ray. It's like this canister full of metal parts. Yeah. And you're like, what the hell? Totally, you're going to try to kill us. I'm like, we will never bring this on a trip again. Yeah. We mailed it home. We mailed it back. We were like, no, I got to get on a plane with that again.
Well, and magnet toys are fantastic.
Oh, yeah, they're great toys. But none of that. It's not good for TSA.
Yeah, I know.
I just want to say, Dave is from Boston, by the way.
Oh, sure, yeah.
He was really paying attention to that.
I mean, that's the risk of saying what your thoughts are about things.
But, you know, the funny thing about being, the era that I grew up in Boston was, you know, 70s. And so at that point, the Celtics were just hanging up banners every year.
Totally right, yeah.
You know, I mean, it was like, not really the Celtics going to get in the playoffs.
Yeah.
If they don't, that will be news. If they do, it's
the Larry Bird, the Danny.
Oh, even before. No, even before that. But yeah. So
the Celtics are one of the most successful sports franchises in history. They don't have a good race record. That's the story.
But because I grew up with the Celtics were basically perennial winners. The Bruins won in 72. 70,
sure, right,
and,
yeah.
And after that, there were nothing.
Yeah.
And the Patriots used to do what the Vikings typically do, which is they start for four games, look great,
yeah,
and then they fall apart.
Yeah.
So in that environment, there was really no point in being a fan because either you were rooting for the team that was guaranteed winner. Which
yeah.
Is, what's your challenge in that?
Yeah.
Or you're rooting for a team that you know is going to disappoint you halfway through
the season. It's a very complex. The psychology of sports is very complicated. When the Vikings are doing bad, I take the laptop into my bathroom and I take a bath. And I feel like they play better after I've had like a soak. And I mean, they beat the Saints. I mean, I feel like the bath was really the key. Mm-hmm. Yes, Kiki.
I would love
please
to share a story.
Bring
about
us back
TSA
on track.
And the yeah. East Coast and going between the Midwest. So when I was 11 years old, my entire family moved from Poughkeepsie, New York to Delafield, Wisconsin, this tiny, tiny town in the most Republican state ever. That doesn't really matter, but anyways, we were flying out from LaGuardia, like the most disgusting airport that I've ever, ever, ever encountered. It's so hot. Everyone's crowded in there. No one's in a good mood. It's horrible. So we were flying out with my mom, my sister, my brother, and our two cats. And we went through TSA, and no one was telling us anything. Like you were saying, like, TSA doesn't actually tell you what you need to do. Like, it's so confusing. Everything is, like, flying past you.
Yeah.
You're all just, like,
there's all this pressure. People
just,
are behind
like,
you. Everyone's trying
yeah
to get to their place.
Everyone's pissed off.
Yeah.
Everyone is pissed off. My mom, especially, is pissed off. And we were bringing our two sweet little kitties in our little carriers through TSA, and my mom puts our cat Rusty, our poor sweet little cat Rusty, through the X-ray machine. Oh my god. And TSA starts cracking up. And it's like, you cannot do this. They see an actual living being going through TSA to project. And the funny thing is, they were making all these jokes like, ha ha, that cat just lost a life. That cat has 8 lives now.
Yeah.
Ha ha ha. My mom was mortified. No, none of us knew what we were doing. I was 11 years old.
Yeah.
We get through TSA and they're just like completely making fun of us. It was horrible. We end up like waiting in the gate for like 7 hours. Our flight got delayed. It was horrific. We were moving. We were moving to a different location.
Yeah.
And our cats were just peeing because they needed to pee.
Right? Sure, right. They're peeing in the cages.
Yeah.
No.
And this lady on the plane was like talking on the phone to her friend. She's like, it smells like cat piss in here. My cat. She's like directly next to my cat carrier. And a couple, like less than a year later, Rusty died.
Aww.
It was Rusty got by
yeah,
that
X-ray. Totally.
So yeah.
Totally. Rusty did get got.
Flying from the East Coast is like
yeah
so much.
No,
it's
very
so
like the smooth airport of Minneapolis is like a big selling point.
Yeah.
And also
totally.
There's a lot of East Coast people
I
here.
Agree.
It's weird. I was like never wanted to live on the East Coast, but I have like a lot of
East
Coast,
Coast
friends.
Fun.
It's because yeah I speak my mind.
Hmm.
Yes. Sophie.
Sorry.
Can I use your name on the air? Is
that's
that
fair.
Okay?
I don't care.
How much am I slurring after 2 cans of wine?
Perfect
like
zero.
Nice.
Okay.
It's
like
I'm a professional.
It's like Sarah Lee's handwriting when I was in 6th grade. She had great handwriting.
Oh, thank
it's a
you.
Sloop, this little
yeah, totally.
To
it's
the
like
side.
I'm in the flow. Yeah.
You're Sarah Lee level.
I mean, it's funny like how much of like yeah. Yeah.
Like the bread?
No, no, that's her name. No, she was a friend of mine in sixth grade, but also her name spelled the exact same way as the bread and the cheesecake as it was.
Yeah.
First of all, I can really, like, 11-year-old Kiki is holding a spot in my mind.
No.
And it's like,
did 11-year-old Kiki look like she was 0 years old?
Yes. Yes.
Second of all, I have my own TSA story, but it's not about me. It's about another Gen Z character who's not here. It's Rose Wimberly. Who gets stopped in the super x-ray machine. They're like, you have bomb-making material on your hands. You are 8 years old. Like, they're stopping 8 years. Yeah, I mean, it doesn't care. They don't fucking care. They're like, 8 years old, bomb, whatever.
Right.
And Rose gets through. She's like, Mom, it's my makeup. You know? It's the children's makeup. They put bomb materials for, you know, like in Claire's, they have these, like, petroleum heavy.
I mean, it's a.
I sprayed the Libby Lou perfume in my eyes one time,
and like I was by the
I got blinded, like temporarily.
It's like at home TSA agent doing
things. But in reality, it's like, oh, they're like, she has like liberal parents, so.
Yeah, I mean, they're like, we looked her up on the Patriot Act. They have a document on them.
Yeah, well, and like,
her mom will someday have a weed farm.
I mean,
edit that out.
I have to say, I want to like congratulate everyone on telling a good airport story, because usually airport stories are terrible.
Oh, I have.
You know, yeah,
millions.
But, I know. It's a complex, but I think that's the thing with it is you're like, you just give up so much autonomy to do it. And I talk a lot about, have I talked to you guys about Davetown at all? Did we talk about Davetown the last time? Anyway, so like I lived in a house in LA with two other guys named Dave. It's called Davetown.
Davetown.
And one Dave was like one of the best jugglers in the world, and the other Dave was deep into military intelligence, right? And military intelligence Dave was like, I can get through TSA security like 17 different ways. I can bring anything on there. You know, like there's no, you know, so like it's all this theater. I'm just saying the TSA is just theater to make people feel safe, when in reality, like if, you know, you there's like, I mean, I don't know, like I don't know that you can't bring VH you. So clearly I don't know anything about the process, but it is why I am excited to like go on a road trip and like not have to deal with that, you know.
Do you know this Dave is a juggler?
I do know that this Dave is a juggler.
You did know that.
I have a deep kinship with jugglers. The thing about Los Angeles is that so many people come to Los Angeles and their only talent is being good looking, right? And so, like, the vaudeville people of L.A., like, really, I took a shine to them because I'm like, hey, you can do a fucking card trick, you know? Like, you are not just like, look at me, you know? Ah. But, I mean, L.A. is like, when you're in the thick of it, everyone's like, oh, I was homecoming queen, valedictorian, you know, I have $20 million, you know? Like, that's the culture of it, you know? But the thing is, like, they couldn't take the fucking SAT hungover and pass that shit, you know? I mean, but the thing is, like, I'm from Iowa's the home of the standardized test. I know a lot about Iowans and their affinity for self-analysis. Like, Iowans really like to analyze their own data. A lot of computer advancements have come out of Iowa, including the computer. So, you know.
The computer was invented in
Iowa. It was invented in Ames, Iowa. The first digital computer was invented in Ames, Iowa.
Is that right?
One of these books, like, for those of you listening at home, I, like, got some of my favorite books and DVDs and stacked them all up. And then immediately looked through them and I'm like, wow, Dave, there's, like, almost zero women authors here. And so, way to go. Anyways. what were we talking about?
The computer.
Yeah, the computer. So
I just want to say
the Dave
machine.
The invention
of the computer.
Yeah.
Quickly, Thank you for thinking of me when you think about being hungover.
Oh yeah, no problem.
Wow.
I mean, like, we have a deep
We
have a deep connection, and so
we do.
No, the thing about there's a great Tom Wolfe essay about the invention of the computer, and essentially inventing the computer was kind of a messy process, right? Like, the guys at MIT, the guys in the Ivy League schools, they were not it was all about the invention of the microchip, which is you have to put germanium into silicon. That's about as deep as I understand it. And that was happening both in Wisconsin and in Iowa, as well as in Silicon Valley. And so this essay is all about Robert Noyce, who is from Grinnell, Iowa, and he invented the transistorized something. The step between a transistor and a microchip. Then he moved out to California to work with William Shockley, who was like one of the founding members of the computer. Also a guy who was into eugenics and kind of fucking terrifying. But Robert Noyce and William Shockley invented the microprocessor. William Shockley then and Robert Noyce split. Robert Noyce started a company called Fairchild. Fairchild then split into a bunch more companies, which they called the Fair Children of Fairchild. Ooh. The Fair Children of Fairchild are the foundational members of Silicon Valley. Robert Noyce then switched from Fairchild to a company called Intel and invented the whatever Intel shit that they make, which is a computer inside a computer chip. I mean, that was like, went from transistor to computer chip inside of computer chip. And yeah, no, Robert Noyce is a really interesting guy. That was the kind of thrust of the article, is that when you get into Silicon Valley, the egalitarian values of Silicon Valley are not California values. They are congressionalist Christian values, which is like Iowa Christians who don't believe in evangelism and just believe a lot of work in science. It's a very like science-focused Christian sect. But anyways, IBM claimed the invention of the digital computer for a long time, but it was, in fact, invented in Ames, Iowa, where I'm from, which I don't bring up a lot because when you tell people from Ames, Iowa, they have impressions about that. I just let them think what they want to think, you know, because I don't have to, I don't want to, like, get into it. Yes, Kiki.
I have a question. Wait, so you're talking about a Christian, like, sector being egalitarian?
Yeah.
How?
Well,
literally how?
Right. No, I know, like, I mean, this is like a more, this is about like American regionalism, which is like a subject that I've always been very interested in, but just like the diversity of different sects of Christianity, different types of people. So like, where I'm from, like in central Iowa, it's just a much less, I don't know, obnoxious form of Christianity, you know, like there are different forms of it and it's like less obnoxious where I'm from. And so, you know, I mean, that's like a joke that I tell a lot when like someone's like, I'm a hardcore atheist, and I'm like, Catholic school must have been a bitch. And they're like, how did you know I went to Catholic school? You know, it's just like a fun, like, game that I play with myself. But no, I mean, I'm from central Iowa. The county I'm from is called Story County. That was what I called my show that I did in LA. I call it Story County, you know. But no, I mean, I just think that it's funny living in Minneapolis where the impression of Iowans is very negative. I like it. I like flying under the radar, you know. It just suits me well, you know, but whatever, we're all just people. I mean, that's the thing about like the Boston Celtics. Like, I would get mad because when I was growing up, right, people would say like, I root for Larry Bird because he's like me, you know, like I got like a lot of that. And that Larry Bird was like how I began to initially understand racism, right? But then growing up, I realized that's not fucking Larry Bird's fault. Like, Larry Bird is like a man from Indiana who's very, very good at basketball. Like, extremely good, ultra good. Like, he is an artist of basketball. And now I like Larry Bird, but when I was younger, that was like just a thing, which again is not the fault of the Boston Celtics, you know. And so No, I have a very complicated relationship with Boston. I've like learned a lot about Boston. I mean, one of my best friends went to Harvard, and you know, he and I have argued about Boston over like 150 beers, you know, like, I mean, like the subject has been addressed, you know. But I mean, I just think that it's like telling that story about the SAT, ACT tutor, you know. So here's like, here's the great thing about comedians, right? Is that if you hang out with comedians, they will eventually figure out the one thing that you do not want to be made fun of about more than anything in the world, and then they will make fun of you about that thing, and they will not stop. And if you want to continue to hang out, you got to find a way to let it go, right? And it's like this really amazing process. So the first time I met a professional comedian, he was like, I bet you love fucking Terrence Malick movies. And I was like, what the fuck? No one knows who Terrence Malick is. And I do love Terrence Malick movies. And if there's one thing I thought was like above reproach were the films of philosophy professor Terrence Malick, you know? And he was like, I bet you drink green tea. And I bet, you know, and I was like, holy shit, you know? Or I've been thinking about this so much. Like, I have this comedian friend who's from Inglewood. His name is Brody, and Brody is like, I'm just a classic, like, waif, goth, vegan, black man from Inglewood, you know? And I met him at a party, and he asked me, he started talking to me, and he's very perceptive, you know, like, great comedians are super perceptive, and he's asking me a series of questions, and before I know it, I'm telling him my, like, resume, and I'm like, yeah, like, I went to this Midwestern school, and then I got this big scholarship, and then I produced a television show, and then I like worked in the arts, and I give him this whole thing. He's like, wait a minute, you're telling me you did all that shit, and now you're standing on a balcony with me in Los Angeles? You must have fucked up. I'm like, never laughed so hard. And he's right, right? Like, why did I have these amazing jobs and not survive? I didn't understand the politics of all that shit, you know? The politics are complicated, you know? So, yeah, I don't remember what I was talking about, but Brody's hilarious. He's also like, I bet you've dated 3 black women. And I was like, fuck.
Exactly 3.
Yeah. Yeah, no, he was, yeah, he's incredible. So, yeah, what else? Any other questions? Anything anyone wants to say? Yeah.
What does Hoosiers mean to you?
Hoosiers? I mean, what does Hoosiers mean to me? That's like such a complex question to ask a 42-year-old black male basketball fan. I mean,
That movie made a huge impression on me.
Right, totally. I mean, it's a big deal.
Sports, I love that movie.
Yeah, I mean, it's got a lot to say.
Did you know that movie?
Hoosiers.
You know Hoosiers? Gene Hackman.
Oh, shit.
Dennis Hopper.
It sounds like Hooters to me, and I'm like,
well, yeah. It's about a small high school in Indiana.
But like, it's so good. I mean, it's so...
Won a championship.
Just a small town life, and... I mean, I come from a small town.
Yeah.
I don't know.
I mean, I think that there's some, you know, it's about, like, yeah, it's about that. It's about how, like, single people in small towns are totally fucked and have no options.
It's all about the underdog. But the nice thing is, the story...
Sure, there was a theme of the classic thing.
Oh, no, it was. When Gene Hackman met the lady, he's like, it's been a long time. And she's like, you have no fucking idea.
It's David versus Goliath, but they actually lose at the end.
No, they win, man. They win.
Don't they lose?
Nah, man.
I thought they lost.
Nah, Homer McWhitey-White makes the shot.
Do you know the real story of David and Goliath?
No, I don't.
Do you?
No.
Really?
No, Kiki.
Kiki's got...
Are you happy you're a little Christian Iowa boy, you just said? Wow.
No, I said I'm from Christian part of Iowa.
Oh.
Apparently, I read this, like, really insanely, really crazy article about the actual David and Goliath, because I grew up Protestant. Like, I learned a little bit about David and Goliath. I was oh, David won against this giant, this massive, like...
Huge.
Huge.
100+ feet.
And I mean, yeah. And he, like, won against this unlikely, like, opponents. And apparently, like, people that were giants in that age, and they would have horrible depth perception.
Sure, yeah.
And they, like, usually had, like, some disabilities, like, with their, like, mental capacities.
Sure, like, these are people who have, like, something that's caused them to become gigantic.
So you hear the story about David and Goliath, like, David going against this... Like,
really? He just killed a man with a disability?
Yeah. David going against this, like, insane, like, opponent that, like, could overtake him and just, like, fully outsmart him. But, like, it was a person that couldn't see him. He just flicked a little... stone.
He already hit him. He hit him in the eyeball.
It's
a theoretical discussion about people with gigantism having certain disabilities.
Right. Exactly.
You have to remember that this is not something that, like, you know, they've dug out the skeleton of Goliath and found it. They haven't purely a speculative thing on a story. That's
the original story is speculative as well. So it's just like, come on.
Using
like,
that as a tool for othering in the future. You know, like, hey, guys,
that,
watch
you know,
out.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
I just remember the VeggieTales version.
The VeggieTales version of David and Goliath?
Yeah.
I would love to hear this.
What? Yeah, what vegetable did Goliath embody?
A giant mower.
Do you remember?
Was it a zucchini?
A giant squat.
Broccoli versus a giant cucumber.
Okay, yeah. That seems right.
It was a little, like, tiny, like, broccolini baby. Like, you know.
Broccoli.
I mean, like, just to... wrap up the podcast and get to talking.
Wait, we were just getting VeggieTales. Do you want to keep going?
I
do want to know more about the VeggieTales version of David and Goliath, just like I'm into the Animaniacs version of many stories. But the Bible was written in Hebrew and it's up to a lot of interpretations. It's kind of the foundation of Judaism is to, like, interpret what the Bible means, and what it means is complicated and up to interpretation. So, I mean, there is no truth. Nothing is real. This is the David Show.
You've been listening to the Dave Good Show.